Here come once again the Mincing Rascals. This is John Williams. By the way, one listener said to me recently, why is your podcast called The Mincing Rascals? It was Eric Zorn's idea, and we did not ask him about that in this week's podcast. We will have him answer the origination of The Mincing Rascals next week. So tell your friends. Today, instead of going to Chicago news first, we go to Trump land, from the killing of General Qasem Soleimani to the president's speech explaining the current state of affairs. The Rascals will mince on that, on Charlie Rose's epiphany, and on Jussie Smollett. I know, Jussie Smollett, but listen through to that part because it may be the strongest part of this week's pod, which starts right now. Today is Thursday. It's January 9th, 2020 at 12:42 in the afternoon. Hi, it's John Williams again, and we are the Mincing Rascals, a podcast we record at the studios at WGN Radio, downtown Chicago. I'm on weekdays on WGN from 9 to noon.
I'm Steve Bertrand from the WGN Radio Newsroom.
I'm Austin Burke, Vice President of Marketing at the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Lisa Donovan with the Chicago Tribune. I write the daily politics newsletter, The Spin.
I'm Eric Zorn, the accomplishment shading columnist from the Tribune.
The what?
Accomplishment shading.
Okay, I know what you're doing. This is a little game Eric plays at the beginning of the podcast. So do we all get the reference?
No. Are you talking about the coyote?
No, I'm talking about Trump yesterday.
Inability to pronounce words.
Trying to say words.
I do think he has a drug addiction.
I think his dentures may be slipping.
Your campaign of terror, murder, mayhem will not be tolerated any longer.
There are times where he has been asked to give speeches where the whole world is watching, not a rally, not something that's in his wheelhouse, and he gets nervous. I think he's, despite his resume now, I think he's intimidated, and that's him just kind of choking. His color was bad. He was sniffing a lot.
Well, he does that.
You could feel the gravity of it, and you could feel him feeling it. I'm not convinced he doesn't have an issue.
It is a big moment. On the other hand, all the words are written for you, and he seems to do much better when he's unscripted.
Well, that's it, too. He's a bad reader of
other
people's.
And our columnist, Brett Supke, this morning wrote a very good column in which he points out that yesterday was not the test. The test is going to come Thursday night when he appears at a campaign rally, unscripted, and he's going to, who knows what he's going to say then. I believe that this speech that he gave the other day was workshopped to a fairly well to make sure that he didn't say anything that was
didn't take
too
any
far
questions afterwards either.
Didn't take any questions,
which isn't unusual.
It's very unusual, and it's unusual
But I'm sorry. I would say it's not unusual for a president, when he's giving an address to the nation like this, to not take questions after.
But he can be.
But he does
he
all
can
the time.
Be pulled in to answer questions. He's one of those politicians who he can say no questions and what did you ask?
I know.
And get pulled in.
You
and
see his eyes scan the room,
exactly.
And he's looking to see if you're looking. Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian major general in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, the late, was killed with a drone strike. The U.S. killed him last week at an air base in Iraq. Iran responded by firing a dozen missiles into U.S. compounds there. No Americans were wounded or killed. So yesterday, our president addressed the state of affairs, saying that they have stood down, and so far the administration feels no further actions are warranted on our end. Senators were briefed about this yesterday. They asked about the imminent threat that Soleimani posed, the legality of the strike, the overall plan going forward, and many of them were unhappy on both sides of the aisle about the clarity and transparency of the answers.
Wasn't Rand Paul was standing by Senator Lee, wasn't
he? Yeah, Rand Paul was with Lee. Mike Lee of Utah. Yeah.
They had to leave after 75 minutes while they're in the process of telling us that we need to be good little boys and girls and run along and not debate this in public. I find that absolutely insane.
Finally, the Ukrainian airliner that crashed shortly after takeoff in Iran, killing all 176 people on board. It appears that plane was shot down by an Iranian surface-to-air missile by mistake,
right? Right. CBS reported it first, and other U.S. officials say that they saw two blips that indicated missile launches, and then a third radar blip that was the explosion.
Steve, what did you make of the president's speech?
I thought it was I was happy about it. I mean, I was concerned about what he might say. I think he did strike the right tone. And stepping back, I think, that clearly the way these things are supposed to be done, officials who have knowledge of the situation helped write the speech. I thought that was great. I thought it was disgusting that he took a moment to blame Barack Obama and the Iran deal for the missile attack. I just thought that was so beneath. I mean, this is a unique actor, clearly, but again, that just was unbelievable to me.
The missiles fired last night at us and our allies were paid for with the funds made available by the last administration.
Did that jump out at you guys, too?
You can make an Obama connection on the War Powers Resolution. I don't think bringing up the Iran deal, I don't think I agree with the War Powers because Eric was talking about Mike Lee, who I think gave a fantastic response after the briefing, and the response was essentially myself and Rand Paul asked these officials, including Pompeo, who I believe was in the room, if we don't get congressional, if you don't seek congressional approval on this action, what would you ever seek approval on from Congress to take action against Iran? And there was essentially no answer. And I thought of that because I was talking with a friend of mine. He's an Iranian-American. He grew up in Tehran, was there for 30 years. He's a director, fantastic director. And I asked him sort of what the feeling was among his family and friends who are still there. And he said, I think he described it very well, which is that we feel as though we're caught between two forces. One is internal, one is external, and we have no say and nothing to do with either of them. And that's the problem with not seeking approval from Congress for these types of actions, because that same feeling will happen in America, because the representatives of the people seem to have no voice in these declarations of war. And it's a problem now, and it was a problem in 2011 in Libya for the same reason.
Okay, so I'll give you that. But he wasn't talking about the war declaration. I mean, he was blaming
a previous president,
regardless of who it was, for funding the missiles that were used to attack U.S. troops.
He mentioned in two separate instances in that short paragraph where he talked about this.
Iran's hostilities substantially increased after the foolish Iran nuclear deal was signed in 2013. And they were given $150 billion, not to mention $1.8 billion in cash.
He has been bugged by that since it happened.
The speech was presidential for the most part, you know, and I agree with those who said that Trump has this ability to play both arsonist and fireman at the same time. Like, he creates a problem, and then he comes in and says, look, I solved this problem. The question we all have to ask is the world, are we all in a better place now than we were when we gathered here a week ago before all this?
Well, how do you answer that?
I would say probably not right now. It all depends on how things spin out, but we've certainly inflamed tension. We've unified. Iran was having its problems already, right? Their economy is in real trouble. They have a lot of strife in that country over that, and now the country is unified behind what monsters we are, what monsters Donald Trump is. I'm not sure that relations in the Middle East, our relations with Iraq are perilous at this point, too.
Not like they're not going to be able to find another killer.
Well, and of course, what's happened with this exact question is was this attack imminent? Was this, because you don't want the president to, every time the president has to do something, you know, oh, missiles are incoming, let's summon Congress. No, you have, when there are imminent threats, when there are imminent things that need to happen, you can't make it a big committee hearing. But the question was, did he just think, oh, we got this bad guy? The U.S. has apparently had a tail of this guy for years.
Yeah.
That George Bush passed on it, Obama passed on, on assassinating him, and so Trump decided he would do it. The question is, why then? Why now? And so that my answer would be, you know, from what I know of the situation, the world is probably a less safe place now than it was a week ago.
And do you think that what some people do when that question gets asked is they don't answer that, but rather they answer the question, did this guy deserve it?
Right, and no one's arguing that he's not a terrible person who sought to harm people, Americans in the region, and funded terrorists. I mean, he is absolutely a terrible person. The question is, was it an imminent threat? And I think the executive branch in particular over the last two decades has a really bad record when talking to the people about who and who is not an imminent threat. It was only 6 weeks ago when the Afghanistan papers were released. And yet today we're having, you know, Sarah Huckabee Sanders on Fox and Friends saying, you know, it's terrible. It's the last thing we would ever want to do is involve Congress in our foreign policy making, the president.
They can't seem to manage to get much of anything done. I think the last thing we want to do is push powers into Congress's hands and take them away from the president.
I think that we don't know where we stand. And so he needed to be neutral. And and just sort of get through this 15 minutes and get off that stage. I do think that he was rehearsed. I think he was nervous. I have no idea if he has a physiological issue or something, but he needed to be quick and then get out of there. And I think we're feeling that more than ever today because we really don't know where we stand. He can get up there and say, they're standing down. There's a report out of Iran reported to the UN early Wednesday, we're not seeking an escalation of war. But this morning, with this major general saying, oh no, we're coming. We're coming for you. We're coming for you. And an Iranian general. So I don't think we know where we stand. I think that he was told, listen, we need to bring this down and we need to look a little bit duplicitous. There are great people there and I think are on the same side. I think that was the message. And we all want peace in the world, on, and get out of there.
I mean, this guy was not the biggest threat, the worst person in the world. I mean, we haven't tried to take out Kim Jong-un, for instance. Who is, I think, a far bigger threat to the world than Soleimani or any of these other people who we've been taken out. But so you can't say, well, yeah, he does. There are a lot of people in the world. I guess my point is, there are a lot of people in the world who probably deserve to die. The question is, do we kill them? And does that make us safer if we go around killing them like that? So what does that give other countries license to do in our country?
And the point is too that this wasn't a rogue terrorist or a bad actor in a tent somewhere. This was a government official. It was a government official of Iran, a high ranking one, it was an assassination.
And so we should respect that?
It's a different playing field when you're assassinating government officials of your adversaries.
Do you think that this helped Donald Trump in the next election?
Too soon to know.
I thought if the election were tomorrow, he, to Eric's point, he's the arsonist and the fireman, he comes out ahead. The worst man in the world, Soleimani, is killed, and we didn't pay any price for it. The missiles missed on purpose because they're intimidated by us. He looks strong. He looks presidential.
I don't know if the missiles missed because they're intimidated by us. I think the missiles missed because they acted maybe more maturely than we did, saying, we're going to do something, but intentionally so we can say we acted but not provoke.
Yeah.
It was a little bit like the guy in the bar, hold me back, somebody hold me back. there was that element to it. But again, it's January. And the election is not for another, 10 months from now?
Well, put it this way, it doesn't hurt him then either.
I think it's...
It could.
Yeah, I think it could, because I think what a lot of people forget is he ran... A not insignificant part of his campaign was on a non-regime change war policy plank. And I think there are a lot of people on the right. You saw, Charlie Kirk, he who shall not be named, talk about how, oh, yikes, hold it there. We're not going to do regime change. We're not going to do regime change.
Well,
Tucker Carlson blew a gasket.
But
yeah.
The other part of his campaign was that Obama golfs too much.
Because he's playing so much golf. Obama ought to get off the golf course and get down there.
I'm going to be working for you. I'm not going to have time to go play golf.
He played more golf last year than Tiger Woods.
But if I were in the White House, I don't think I'd ever see Turnberry again. I don't think I'd ever see Doral again.
But I'm not going to be playing much golf, believe me. If I win this, I'm not going to be playing much golf.
Well, and he has been of late saying, we got to pull out of these endless mm-hmm. wars. Well, now you are creating chapter 8,000 and the endless wars in the Middle East. So it remains to be seen. All of this stuff plays up right to the minute that we walk into the voting booth, right? And I think that, depending on how this goes, like I said this morning, we all know now that there, the tensions are still high.
That's a funny point, though, Lisa. I mean, if we fast forwarded to November, and if that month were anything like the previous 3 years and 11 months, it would be a day-to-day basis where mm-hmm. our attitude is and his Q score is up or down, because it's just such a crazy roller coaster ride.
On the other hand, though, John, his poll numbers are remarkably stable. I mean, that you would think that some of these things would have plunged him down into the 20s, and then some of these other news would have rocketed him into the 50s. I mean, other presidents, you see, it's like a roller coaster, their approval ratings. He's like sort of low 40s, right? He's like mid-50s disapprove, low mid-40s approve, and it's been stuck no matter what happens.
Where is he amongst Republicans?
Oh, he's like 90%.
95%.
Right. Yeah. So,
which must beg the question, what's a Republican then? Well, I know people that are Republicans, and 9 out of 10 of them don't feel that way. Maybe I'm talking to the wrong ones, but doesn't that number sort of strain credulity to you guys? Is that believable?
To Eric's point, it's believable because it's been almost a natural law. If you remove kind of the noise in the weekly polling, you're right. It's been exactly steady, both approve and disapprove, for 2 years.
And the swing numbers in those polls might be people who are on the edge, and maybe there are fewer people considering themselves Republicans now. So that might tend to
skew up
a little bit. I don't think that's going to make for
I'm
a lot.
I'm not at all sure that any of these poll results are outside the margin of error, that there's no evidence at all that things are moving much at all in these polls. So it's going to come down to geography and turnout. And who's excited on election day? And are Republicans going to be more excited to get out and vote than Democrats? And where are they going to be excited to come out and vote? And that's going to depend on who the Democrats nominate.
Did you guys notice also the framing of the president's speech? I'll leave the speech, but it was just, to me, really riveting. The vice president and the defense secretary stand on either side of the podium, and then he's flanked by all the brass behind him, all the military guys, and then he comes out front and center. And, I mean, it looked like a scene from The Apprentice or something, where the staging was very choreographed.
It was a grave moment. I mean, we assassinated a government leader. That's a big deal.
So presidents do this, and it wants to send a message. And I of all the problems I have with Trump, this is, I would say, not one of them.
Do you think this is going to fade? This what's your hope or what's your guess, Lisa? This is just going to be another chapter, or is this going to endure what's happened this week?
Well, I don't think it's. I don't know that it's going to affect November. But I don't think that it ends right here. No, I think we are going to be in conflict, and I think we're going to see it right through the spring, right through the primary season. Again, I don't know. It depends on what happens, right? If we get into a full out conflict, right? That's what the government wants us to call it now, rather than a war.
Oh, really? I didn't miss that memo. Yeah. But that's what we're calling it now.
It's a war.
Authorized use of military force rather than war.
Fracas.
Yes. UMF.
Fracas.
And we'll see what happens. I really feel like this whole vote today to sort of rein in Trump's war powers, his authority, I think it's going to play out just like the impeachment, right? The Democratic-led House is going to vote to rein him in, and the Senate, despite some defectors, I think, in the Republican Party, the Republican-led Senate will say no.
But that is a long-term institutional issue, right? I mean, you talked about the War Powers Act. The fact is, Congress has sort of abdicated its power over the president, and not just this president, but over the past 30 years.
How long is it? Both parties. Both parties had plenty of opportunity to pull this back. I'm not disagreeing with you.
I'm saying it's bipartisan here. It's an institutional thing. It's a branch of government. I mean, we've not declared war since World War II, and we've certainly been involved in a number of wars since then. And I think the Congress has sort of given that up. And one day they're going to have to take it back. They're not going to take it back now.
No.
But I don't think we've had a president who's imagined his powers as an extension of his ego, or hasn't been so obvious about it. That's the frightening thing. I mean, forget about the policy. It's when somebody like him has those sorts of powers that gives you pause.
But I would rather that we untether a decision like that from the current occupant of the White House and make a principled decision, a long-term decision, over what kind of powers do we want the president to have in 4 years, in 8 years, in 12 years.
Yeah.
Because Donald Trump will be gone someday, and somebody else will be there, and there will be another Democratic president, and do I want that president to be constrained by Congress? My answer is yes. So maybe they could pass a law saying, in 8 years, we'll do this. But they need to do that.
Oh, that's a nice idea.
So Obama took out Osama bin Laden. And I would imagine some people listening here are saying, well, what's the difference there? The answer is there was the authorization of force for the, and that's when the last time they passed it was for the 911 bombing.
AUMF essentially allows the U.S. government, enormous latitude, the executive branch, to go after anyone involved in the 9/11 attacks. The problem is it keeps getting used for every possible thing you can imagine. But Eric's point, and Steve, I think both of your points are good. What is the institutional back and forth? So we've had Libya, Yemen, and Syria. All were done unilaterally by the executive branch. The State Department sought congressional approval for Libya, didn't get it, and did it anyway. And Obama called the fallout from that one of the biggest mistakes of his presidency. He didn't understand that. He didn't think through the fact that that would plunge North Africa into chaos, that would cause the Libyan civil war. And maybe if we had a Congress that cared about this duty, that mistake wouldn't have been made.
Do you think we're really going to solve this, though, in this politically polarized climate that we're in, I don't know that at least right now this is something that can be decided sort of objectively. How do we want to proceed going, you know, in 10, 12, 13, 30, 50 years? I don't know that we can objectively do that right now.
Yeah, it's a good question.
I can. you guys can discuss among yourselves.
I like Eric's idea that we'll go ahead and accommodate the current president, but make the rule apply to the president after that. Sort of grandfather, reverse grandfather it in, because I think some of these same questions should be asked about how we impeach a president, too. I'd hate to see that the impeachment tool be used just to punish any president that either party doesn't like. And you sort of get the feeling, listen to Republicans these days, that this is such a frivolous case against Donald Trump that they're going to do it to the next Democrat that comes along, and I'd hate to see that happen.
Well, we know Abraham Lincoln would have been impeached.
Yes, exactly.
And he might have been.
Different subject now. We've been hearing more this week about a November deposition in which former CBS and PBS newsman Charlie Rose admitted to flirting with female co-anchors and having workplace relationships. So you have Gayle King, Norah O'Donnell, and Bianna. No one seemed to object, Charlie Rose said. He's had relationships over the years with colleagues, some of them in his 20s. He sees now that those relationships were, quote-unquote, inappropriate. And then, Eric, you sent me something. Is this from the deposition as well?
Yes, it's from the deposition.
Quote, I wasn't thinking about specific people, Rose said during the deposition. I was thinking of my own sense of passion. This is about his behavior. My history and respect for women. My sense of emotional connection to gender equality. My idea of always being a champion and in that capacity. I don't even know what he's talking about here.
He was being asked at that point about what he admitted to inappropriate conduct. I said, well, what do you mean by inappropriate conduct? And I guess he inappropriately cared too much about gender equality.
I was thinking of my own sense. This makes no sense. Yeah, they're asking you, why are you flirting with these ladies or coming on to them?
His passion for gender equality.
I think my sense in reading that, I was trying to kind of go back and look at sort of some of the pieces of the transcript that were reported. I think what he was getting at is, like, I wasn't thinking about sort of preying on women. If I understand that right, I was thinking about the individual. I was attracted to these 35
well, is
women.
Is it a crime to love women now?
Yeah, right, right. God,
so I was thinking of my own sense of passion, my history and respect for women, my sense of emotional connection to gender equality.
This is a great answer for a job interview, isn't it? What is your biggest flaw? My biggest flaw is that I just
respect women too much.
I respect women too much.
My question is sort of like, on YouTube is the font of every interview with every great person that you have ever wanted to learn about. And so many of the good ones are Charlie Rose. And now whenever I watch them, I'm not going to be able to get that statement out of my head.
Or the image of him in his bathrobe that you could never get out of your mind from some of these earlier news stories.
It's just so weird to me because we watched that show all of the time at my house. We were fans of Charlie Rose, Gayle King, and Norah O'Donnell at the time. And they would flirt with him. And there was this sort of running banter between Gayle King and Charlie Rose. And they would all sort of tease him about being...
Oh, baby, what you've done to me. You make me feel so good inside.
Oh.
The news is back in the morning.
I'm going to die and go to heaven right now.
We want you to know you make us feel alive inside.
Oh, my baby. I can't tell you what you do to me.
You can take it many ways.
I had no idea that the backstory was that he was engaging in that kind of behavior with everybody.
But you're saying that they didn't know this?
Yeah, Gayle King and Norah O'Donnell, when he left the first day he wasn't on, they sat there, looked at the camera and said,
I'm really struggling because what do you say when someone that you deeply care about has done something that is so horrible? How do you wrap your brain around that? I'm really grappling with that. Because this is not the man I know.
Because I thought there were references to in some of the stories of, you know, this girl got the full Charlie Rose. You know, where they did the interview in the bath towel or things like that. It was the full. So I thought it was kind of widely known. But, I mean.
I think these were younger junior employees. I don't think that he was
so
doing
it. So never
that.
Got up to them.
I don't know that it got up to them. But the women who are suing were very much like these junior employees. And he was saying, come up to my house. And,
right.
You know, but I better not catch you swimming naked in my pool. You know, that kind of stuff.
He cared so much. He cared so much. Is anyone watching The Morning Show, by the way? The Apple TV series, Jennifer Aniston, Steve Carell.
Is it good?
Oh, I love it. It's
really
great.
Because
oh, yes.
The reviews out of the gate were terrible.
The reviews were wrong. It's great. It's a great show.
I mean, I think
it's worth the price of admission.
Well, we got it because Johanna had to buy a new laptop, so you get a year free Apple TV. So, yeah. But we were totally hooked.
I think Rose is trying to argue though in all of this, and I'm not sure. I do want to watch that show, but I think what Rose is trying to argue here is that times have changed. That's what he's subtly getting at here, and I'm not sure.
Well, he's right about that. Times have changed.
Well, maybe for him, but for those of us who have been subjected to women who have been subjected to this kind of stuff, you know, he thought it was his right. You know, people like him think that this is my right. Hey, I'm this famous guy. I've been, you know, I've got all these people around me saying yes, and so should you. You know, I'm famous, I'm rich, I can get anything that I want. And so I don't really think he understood his power in that way.
Do you think he thought, this is what a ridiculous question to ask you, what he thought about this. But I wonder if guys like him or Charlie Rose thought that the flirtation was mutual. That is, he's attracted to them, and he's a famous, good-looking guy. They're attracted to him.
Well, one of the things he raises, which I think is separate, and it is kind of, I always thought it was a strange thing. Forgive me if anybody doesn't hear, but he brought up the fact that, oh, you know, when I would see my coworkers at a certain point, we would caress each other's arms. We'd kiss each other hello, kiss each other goodbye. I might have done it with men, but I know I did it with women. I always thought that was kind of a strange sort of interaction among sort of adults who were friends.
Americans it is.
Yeah, right. But I think I grew up with parents who did that with their friends. And so I was like, I wonder how old I have to get before that happens. I hope it, and I kind of hope it never does with some people, you know. And so when it happens now, but not with colleagues, you know, certainly. Actually, somebody did, like, there was some award ceremony, and a boss, like, kind of kissed me on the cheek. I was like, ew. But I don't think that they meant anything by it. I just think it was one of those things.
Well, has anybody in this room done that, kissed hello a colleague in any capacity at work, not at a wedding reception?
I'm going to say no, John. That's my answer. No, I don't know. I mean, I can't. No, it's completely unthinkable in the workplace.
And I think what Charlie Rose is trying to sell, and Matt Lauer is trying to sell, times have changed, and they just changed like 10 minutes ago.
Right.
Maybe they actually, in their twisted head, are just now getting that message.
If I can speak for Lisa.
Explain it to her, though.
Please.
Lisa, here's what you meant to say.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the mansplaining.
What has changed with the times is our awareness of the inappropriateness, not the inappropriateness. That has been constant.
Okay, but do you think that? But
is that?
I think there was an awareness among women like this in cases of people like this where you got sort of like the veteran reporter at the Christmas party that they used to have saying, yeah, you want to steer clear of him. He's doing his third shot, you know, or you want to, like, you'd have the sorority of women who would kind of guide you, like, okay, he is going to ask you out because he asks every woman out and it's not cool. I mean, he's a boss, and so just kind of dodge it, you know, so that you don't get penalized. I remember all of these conversations going on and then passing it on to the next new person.
Really? So this has been your experience,
too. Then I'm wrong about saying the awareness, obviously,
I think there is a wider awareness that it's not appropriate and that you could be penalized for it. But I don't think
repercussions have certainly
changed. Yeah, there are repercussions, but I don't think that, I mean, and I'm not saying this is a good thing, but I don't think that women felt that they could do anything about it. That a lot of times it was subtle, or, you know,
well, just the number of allegations against Charlie Rose and against Harvey Weinstein.
35.
I mean, all these people. So that clearly women did not feel empowered to say anything about it. They didn't think anyone was going to take them seriously. And you know, Steve's right. It was always inappropriate, but there was what awareness wasn't there on their part was the awareness that anybody would care or do anything about it.
I think you felt like if you spoke up in any way that you were automatically, if you're a young journalist, for instance, that's who some of these folks were working for Rose. I think you might feel that, okay, there is no next rung for me. There is no next. I am done. I will be blackballed. Whether he would do something about it or not, you would be seen as this person who's a problem.
And when some of them went to the CBS officials, nothing was done. They didn't get any traction.
Well, Les Moonves was running that operation, right?
But so. I think Steve is maybe giving Charlie Rose too much of a pass, Steve. It sounds like you're saying, well,
yes,
he just realized.
I don't think. Go ahead.
It just dawned on him most recently the inappropriateness of it. Right?
Well, I didn't, and Austin, you can speak for me in a minute, but I don't think I'm giving him a pass at all. I think
you just said something along these lines that
Steve, what
it's
you
always
should
been
have said is that
she was inferring that it was always inappropriate, and you're saying, yeah, but guys are just now getting the message that it was inappropriate.
No, I think you didn't understand what I was saying. I said that that it was always inappropriate.
What Steve meant to say clearly was that there is an awareness, I think you were borrowing from me, that there's an awareness that you are going to be penalized now for it.
Right.
And it's almost, Rose is sort of positioning this, though, let's roll it back a little bit. He's positioning this as sort of what you said, which is sort of like, things have changed now for us. It's sort of this universal
right,
we.
So
and it's not sort of like, don't put this on me. This is, times are changing. Our culture has changed. And so I was part of this thing before, and now I realize in the aftermath that it's no longer appropriate. So he's almost making it, he is making it sound like it was once okay. But now we realize that sort of as we examine and look deeper, that there's a power dynamic there, and it's not appropriate.
The power dynamic is the key thing, because what mm-hmm. that really odd statement where he's talking about, oh, I was overcome with my feelings of gender equality, is what I think he means to say by that is I was ignorant of the power dynamic. And actually, I think men and women are equal. And the fact that I'm Charlie Rose and this big hitter in the journalism community, you know, I actually thought these women, you know, were on the same playing field as me and thought they could go and report all this. That's what that's really reading between the lines.
This is what he says. This is part of the deposition. He says, quote, we have now come to understand and appreciate that romantic relationships or intimacies were not appropriate in the workplace because, you know, because there was power and balance. And you were, in some cases, the boss. And you had a relationship that was defined within that workplace. So it's the royal we. It's times have changed, and now we don't do that anymore. So
do you think, though, but I know I asked this question a moment ago, but I wonder if, at the time, how could he have not realized that this was a power imbalance issue, that it wasn't a level playing field? Did he really think that these 20-something-year-old women were attracted to him?
Because people like him don't have to think about that. People in that position of power don't have... They, and I'm not trying to, you know, nail the guy to a wall. I'm just saying they don't have to think about it.
This is explored very well in The Morning Show, by the way. Just the whole question of the main character, Steve Carell, is the Matt Lauer or
all right,
Charlie
well,
Rose
bring
character.
Your wife's laptop in next week and we'll watch
it. I'll watch it. But essentially, you do get the feeling that he sincerely thinks that these women are coming on to him. He sincerely thinks that he is attractive to them, but just as
well,
a
this
man.
Is part of that storyline.
And so I don't think that it's unthinkable to think that there is an obtuseness to men in that situation who think like, hey, yeah, I mean, she likes me for my wit and my physique or whatever. I mean,
yeah,
but I think that they don't understand that power dynamic, or they choose to ignore it in their passion for gender equity.
Would a Mincing Rascals podcast be complete without a Jussie Smollett update?
Oh my God!
Special Prosecutor Dan Webb has been looking into the case and how Kim Fox's office handled it. I was amazed at the breadth of stuff that they are looking at. His geo stuff on Google for a year, his deleted files, his searches.
Yeah, I mean, not just the night or the weekend,
right.
but
for
year.
A year.
And a year that did not include the date on which it happened. It's November to November. So you have a year's worth of all data stored by Google related to
that.
This stuff only happened between January and late March 2019.
Right.
I think what authorities might be looking at is sort of these any incriminating remarks, you know, kind of getting your story together, especially after, you know, Fox recuses herself and says, you know, I don't know anything about this. And in the appearance of me talking to some of the players here, when it was first believed that Smollett was a victim, right? And then it turns out that he is a suspect, accused of setting this whole thing up of a racially you know, homophobic attack in the middle of a downtown street. You know, first we believe he's a victim, of course. I think most people would tend to believe, okay, nobody's going to make that up. And then Fox was talking to some people, I believe, in the family and friends of the family. And then suddenly it turns around and the cops are saying, no, we believe that he arranged this. And so now they are looking to see sort of like, okay, what happened before, during, and way after? Is he trying to get his story together? Because this thing was sort of rapidly moving in different directions. They just want to know who he was talking to.
To continue Eric's commercial for Apple, is this a reason to have an iPhone? Because are less likely to turn that data over by the encrypted cell phones and things like that?
Well, don't use Gmail. Don't use Google Maps. I mean, Google stored data on this person.
If you're using
an
iPhone, it's Google.
Yeah, I conduct my searches with Google on my iPhone, and I use Gmail, so... That's come at me, Dan Webb.
seems like huge overreach.
Oh, doesn't it? I mean, it seems scary to me, and I don't have secrets like that to hide, but I just like, wow, really? You go through my entire year? Because you know that with geolocation and all your Google searches and all your Gmail...
Your pictures,
all,
right?
And your photos, if they're... Yeah, that the record of your life would be fairly complete.
And you could... to pick and choose elements of that to construct an entirely different narrative.
Right, you could probably stitch together a bunch of narratives, couldn't you?
And I just wonder if this opens the door for some kind of precedent. It is a layman's term, a fishing expedition, really.
Yes.
And I wonder what kind of... I think it's scary, too. I wonder what kind of...
Well, that happens all the time. It happened to Donald Trump. It happened to anybody. When you give a special prosecutor the sort of powers they have, there's no telling what they find sometimes.
The lucky thing for Kim Fox is that this search is so broad and this investigation is so wide-ranging that it may not be done by March 17th, which is when the primary is.
But does she get tangled up in this somehow, though? I mean, if they're going to look at a year's worth of stuff, does that boomerang around on her some way, or since it's after the fact?
And also, what's going to boomerang toward her right now is this business with the fact that she has hired outside counsel to help the office. So we're paying for the investigation. We're paying for the defense of the investigation. We've already paid for the Smollett investigation. This is an extremely expensive and strange story, and that it could have been, if she had just gotten Smollett to plead guilty, we would not be talking about
this.
We'd have to talk about something else.
Eric, I mean, but there it is. But I mean, but she didn't do that. So there you were. You could have just said, all right, fine, let's just cut bait. Let's just stop. Or let's do this thorough investigation. Which would you prefer?
Oh, I think the thorough investigation has to be done if she's not going to come clean.
Not because we care about Smollett so much, but because we care about Kim Fox.
It gets to the integrity of Kim Fox. It gets to the integrity of the transparency and honesty of this institution, the state attorney's office, a very powerful institution.
So she's the one that stands to suffer the most from the results of this.
You know, people keep saying this is just a silly little story, and it is in some ways, but it has these wider implications, which is why it's going to be a huge story in the next couple of months, because... everybody I talk to about the state attorney's race wants to talk about Jussie Smollett and Kim Fox. And she can hope that people will say, like, oh, well, she's done all these great reforms and she's been a great state attorney in many ways. I'm sorry. That's the way the world works, is you have a story like that hanging out there. You got to deal with it.
See, I think that there's sort of this three-pronged attack against her. I think Smollett is part of it. There's plenty of people who are sick of it and want to move on and are asking, you know, what has she done that's been great? And I do think she's done a lot of good things in terms of sort of reform, trying to get people who are nonviolent offenders onto a path of you know, rehab if they need drug rehab, et cetera. But the other prongs of this that her rivals are seizing on her, I don't know if you guys, especially on the weekends, we've got these aldermen out talking to TV cameras about this burglary and that burglary and theft at stores, and Kim Fox is not holding people accountable. So that's one little thing I heard. I actually heard it with friends over Thanksgiving. Somebody was like going to town on that. They're not arresting these, you know, these thieves, these burglars.
Shoplifting is becoming a bigger problem.
Yeah. And then you have the whole idea that people who are charged in gun cases are getting out on Monday, which I'm not sure the numbers bear out that it's always happening, but people are seizing on those cases where it has happened. And so there are all these building blocks. I'm curious about what will happen with this primary. She's got three challengers, and they're coming after her.
And last time this came up on this podcast, I believe the panel felt that she wins re-election because she can win the primary because of the number of people.
And since we said that, she's doubled down. I mean, she's gotten huge union campaign cash in the last 2 weeks. I mean, that's going to keep coming. And she has a massive built-in advantage over the field.
Do we have anything to say about Mike Madigan perhaps being caught up in this investigation of WBEZ reported out this email where there was a state worker was going to be disciplined, but he was a good guy because he covered up a rape.
The language in that was stunning to me, that somebody would digitally put that somebody would be able to mine it again, right? If we're talking about the same quote,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. This is a lobbyist who was emailing back in 2012 Governor Quinn's aides, correct? And saying, hey, this person is facing some disciplinary action, but you... Let's go light. He's loyal, quote, loyal to the administration. I just want to know more about
the author
this.
Of that piece, though. The author of that
yes,
email
is a lobbyist.
It's a lobbyist.
McClain.
Yes.
Yeah, McClain.
And he is a confidant of House Speaker Mike Madigan. He has been now sort of dragged into this FBI public corruption investigation.
Well, they searched, this is Michael McClain, and they searched his house, right?
They raided his house, which is in Quincy, Illinois.
And you know, all the time, and I've been saying this for years, that I think that Mike Madigan is too cautious to get caught committing an illegal act. If he commits illegal acts, he's too cautious to get caught doing them. This may go beyond that, though. This may be where McClain gets squeezed enough, and he may say that, you know, I told Madigan about this, and Madigan knew about this alleged rape. He knew about this cover-up. And it wouldn't be a crime for Madigan to say, oh, well, that's fine, you know, to ignore that. It's not like he's not got first-hand responsibility for it, but it would be a serious enough breach of decency that I could see this being the spelling the end for his career. I mean, I know I'm stealing a bunch of bases here to get there, but I see in this story something that I haven't seen in other stories, which is just a plausible way that this could spell real trouble for Michael Madigan.
He's kept his mouth shut on the Jones ghost workers, the rape in Champaign, and other items. He's loyal to the administration, McClain wrote in the email July 31st, 2012. Don't put that in an email.
So that's the point, though. Think about how much hubris you have to have as a person to write your state government. These weren't just like low-level aides. They were, I believe, Quinn's chief of staff and chief legislative liaison in an email saying, do not discipline this person because he kept quiet about a rape. That's to the state government. And Mike McClain is not just a Madigan confidant. He was Madigan's right-hand man in Springfield for 40 years. They served in legislature together in the 70s. He ran the entire lobbying operation. You go to McClain to figure out which lobbyists to pay off to get Madigan to pass something. He maintained the donor list for the Democratic Party of Illinois, which Madigan also controls. He was the bag man for all of this stuff. And at what point are you going to have a significant number of Democratic lawmakers and leaders in Illinois call out that behavior? When does it become a pattern that Mike Madigan just doesn't know about his key friend's harassment and abuse of women? Because this is the third one. We had Kevin Quinn, we had Tim Mapes, and now we have this. And at what point does he keep getting to say he doesn't know about this?
Well, yes, I agree with that. I think that the Quinn and Mapes were maybe a little bit too low level for something to. I mean, those
Mapes
were not,
is chief of staff.
Those were not rapes, though. Those that was
no, but it was harassment of women. Yeah.
So harassment. But I think your point is his plausible deniability keeps getting eroded, and at some point, and you saw that in some of the statements yesterday from some of the Democratic lawmakers. They were fairly aggressive about, hey, let's get to the bottom of this now. They were not like, well, I mean, because in some of the earlier cases, they were, you know, I've always known Michael Madigan to be very respectful of women. You know, I mean, that they were, there was a serious amount of trembling in some of the statements they made. I did not catch that yesterday. I've caught some aggressive stances here. I think I mean, I'm wrong. I mean, is this a turning point?
I feel like this is, I do feel like we're jumping the gun a little bit. We don't know what these references are to. I just want to urge a little bit of caution. I don't know I'm sorry, but I've been making calls to
everybody else. Yeah.
No, I just don't, I guess I'm a little bit stunned that somebody would put that in an email. And so my brain goes to the worst case scenario, but then I have to rein myself in and say, okay, no, you need to start from the beginning and find out exactly what this is about. I agree. People smarter than me and more plugged in than me, I'm sure, are trying to find out and are finding out as we were sitting here talking. But I just, I don't know. Are we talking about Emil Jones, who used to be the Senate president? Who are they talking about?
Emil Jones was not Senate president then.
Way back. This is somebody who's been around for decades. He's talking about being loyal.
And his wife was a state official for a long time.
Right. And so he's talking about, he's trying to go back deep into sort of, this is how loyal this guy has been. And, now he has a state, he did have a state contract until last night, right? The guy that they were talking about, the guy who was to be disciplined.
And he was a Pritzker campaign worker because McClain recommended him.
I agree. Right. I agree that, it's too early to make anything, but just this story does feel somewhat different to me even than the earlier cases that you talked about. It feels like, especially with McClain's connection, so close to Madigan and the brazenness of this statement in the email, there's a quality of his story that feels more earth-shaking than the others.
Some state representatives are being more vocal than ever before, and Kelly Cassidy has, I think, particularly taken a great stance on this and has been really strong and been forthright about why this is a problem. Here's where we need to look, though. Every time something like this happens, so that's in Madigan's orbit, there's a very clear playbook, and it's essentially triage. We have to get to the bottom of this one isolated incident, then this person is cut out, and then we wipe our hands, and it's done. My point about the gall you have to send an email about that is that it's a symptom of the concentrated power that one person has in Springfield. And until you fix that, you are going to keep having McClain-esque characters feel like they're untouchable. Hmm. And we never have people talking about the structural reasons for that power. People aren't talking about the House rules. They're not talking about how Madigan shouldn't be chairman of the Democratic Party. They're just talking about how Mike McClain said something awful in an email.
Right. You're absolutely right. The person feeling that they have the power, that it's okay to write something so casual and so damning. It just sort of like, whatever. I'm untouchable.
I'm on board with term limits for legislative leadership positions. I don't know why that... Well, I guess I do. Of course, I know why it hasn't happened. But ethically, I don't understand why that hasn't happened. That would be an incredibly important reform, I think.
Here's the Madigan statement. These are extremely serious and troubling allegations. I had no knowledge of the incident referenced in the story and only learned of this today. I encourage those with any information to come forward.
It's possible, sure.
That he didn't know anything.
Sure.
But suppose...
Absolutely possible.
If he does or doesn't, though, what's the worst case scenario for him? I mean, is there a crime that Mike Madigan has committed here, or just that this is so unpalatable that he loses his leadership position or something like that?
The latter would be my suspicion if it unspools the way it might. I mean, Mike McClain is got his private parts in a vice here, I think, with the search of his house and with this email coming out. And maybe he is loyal to the end. Maybe he doesn't have anything to say. Maybe he's, maybe he was acting completely independently and everything's on the up and up.
But don't forget, he's also involved in part of the... interesting thing about McClain is also his wife is involved because her name is on a check that he cut to Kevin Quinn, who was dismissed from Mike Madigan's organization for sexual harassment. So that's another way he's in a vice. But the problem I have a lot of problems with that Madigan statement. One of them is allegations. What specifically is alleged by releasing this email? You have your top lobbyist and top confidant emailing the state to say go easy on disciplinary action for a state worker. Why is that appropriate? That's not even alleged. That is what the email is, regardless of what the rape and champagne is and regardless of what the ghost payrolling is.
But it's not a government official asking for that, right? I could ask.
It's a lobbyist.
It's a lobbyist. Okay, I guess they maybe
operate. But has the clout to ask that?
Why should a lobbyist be able to ask that?
Yeah. No, think
under
about what you just said.
Madigan's power.
No, but maybe that's it. But I mean, anybody could ask anything. I could ask for you to give me a brand new car. They say, I can't give you a brand new car. So I can ask. So maybe it sounds awful, but really, are we saying that it was granted? Should these things happen?
Shouldn't Madigan have said it is completely inappropriate for a state government lobbyist to be suggesting disciplinary action for a state worker?
Well, let me go back to his statement and see if that's
or, yeah. or is it appropriate?
I don't believe he said it.
No. He should have said that, too. Okay, guys, we're out of time. Any last things? Are you guys all watching Jeopardy?
Yes.
This James Holzhauer from Naperville is in the greatest of all time tournament of champions on Jeopardy this week.
Those guys are smarter than I am.
They're smarter than computers. They're so good that somebody said, this isn't even that entertaining. They get all of, they get all of the questions right. It's like if somebody said in Slate this week, if you had LeBron James, Michael Jordan, Kobe Bryant, all playing a basketball game, and they all hit three-pointers and they never miss, that'd be kind of interesting, but it's not as compelling as... maybe
real competition.
Who are you rooting for?
Well, I guess you're, you know, I'm a homer. Let's pick this James Holzhauer guy, who is a nice guy. He's the fellow that left Naperville, moved to Las Vegas, where you can bet legally on sports. He's been kicked out of more than half of the casinos in Vegas, not because he's counting cards, but because he's so good at handicapping games and understanding sports that he wins too much. So he can't, but he can bet online, and that's what he does for a living.
And I'm really enjoying watching the sportsmanship of the three of them when they're competing. They're laughing and making jokes and congratulating each other. They seem to be in like this little group of people who really understand one another. And
the tension of who's going to win is a little lost in this when you consider this is the greatest of all time championship. It's more like an exhibition game for them. The two of them get $250,000 and the winner gets $1 million. They've already made many millions of dollars each. So that's an interesting point, Eric. Maybe
it's more of a freak show than a competition.
I know. The tension's not there.
Bring back Hollywood Squares.
if only Paul Lynde were still alive.
Thank you, Lisa, for coming in. Austin and Eric. Steve Bertrand had to exit. He does a radio newscast here at WGN every now and then. I'm John Williams. We're produced by Elif Garris. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.